Welcome to episode 253 of Fly Away. We're a group of agents from Outlander Travel who get together every week to talk about all things travel. Whether you've been listening for a while or are just tuning in, we're happy you found us. We truly believe that travel has the power to change the world, and we want to inspire others to come along with us. We chat about destinations, current events, our favorite experiences, and lots more. We'd love to hear your feedback and ideas for topics, so be sure to connect with us on our website, Facebook, or Twitter. My name is George, and this week I'm joined by fellow Outlander travel agents Sandy, Lindsay, Laura, and Elizabeth. Whether through film, music, or the immersive experience of a theme park, at some point in our lives, it's safe to say that we have all enjoyed the fruits of Walt Disney's hard work and imagination. Our love of all things Disney is no big secret, so as we approach Walt's birthday, we thought it might be fun to take a deeper look at the ways in which Walt Disney has inspired our lives. So let's get started.
Let me count the ways. I love this.
One Mickey dollar, 5 million Mickey dollars.
So I was born just 3 months before Walt Disney World was born. So I feel that special connection. Yes, Walt Disney World, not Disneyland, before we start thinking that I'm at all. But I remember as a child, like all I wanted to do was go to Disney World. I would see the Mickey Mouse Club and everything on television. And that was all I wanted. And I swear, I think my parents were going to kill me if I brought it up one more time.
Really?
Yeah. And then in 1977, my grandfather was like, I have an idea. Let's all go to Disney World. And I'm like, yes. So honestly, that was, other than the, you know, South Carolina beaches, which we did every year, that was my first, and in New York, where we went to visit my family, that was my first big vacation, like trip. I flew in an airplane, and yeah, it was a big, big deal. So if nothing else, that's probably where my love of going places started.
So you didn't live in New York, though?
No, I lived in North Carolina. My grandfather lived in New York, though. So, and he decided he was going to play a golf tournament. They had like a senior PGA tournament, although I don't know that my grandfather was that good at golf, but I have no idea. I was really young. And but he would play in these tournaments, and he was like, I'm going to go down there and golf, so you guys should go to the parks. And I'm like, yes! And we stayed at the Polynesian, and I have these great pictures of me and, like, Granimals.
Aren't you, like, swimming in the lake?
You could swim in the lake, yes. In fact, I mean, years later, I was convinced that Orlando was on the shore. Like, I thought we went to the beach because we stayed at the Pawnee, and I thought it was a beach. You know, when you're five, everything looks really big. And so I really thought the monorail sort of went around the ocean, you know. And I swear, I was probably a preteen or a teenager when my mother was like, no, I'm going to show you where Orlando is on the map. You have no idea what you're talking about. And I was so confused. I was like, how can it be in the middle of Florida? There was a beach there. Yeah, I had no idea. That's how real the magic was for me. I mean,
I had like the exact opposite post-Disney trip. Elizabeth, you lived in North Carolina and flew because your parents were smart. I lived in Wisconsin and we drove.
To be fair, it wasn't my parents' decision, it was my grandparents' decision. The whole time my dad was like, we should be driving. This is excessive.
Stayed off property, and I got to experience Disney and Epcot for the very first time on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day with no planning. Zero planning involved.
I'm just trying to wrap my head around the fact that Epcot was open at that time.
Yeah, really.
I mean, it wasn't much later, I guess, that Epcot opened, but.
Yeah. Our first trip, we had just moved from Pittsburgh to Myrtle Beach. And then that summer we took our family vacation to Walt Disney World, but we only spent 1 day, I think, maybe 2 days, but it was only Magic Kingdom. We camped, we stayed at a campground. We went to Busch Gardens. And we went to a place called Circus World. I mean, it was kind of, yeah, Disney was not the main focus of it for us that time. So
it was the main focus.
So, what do you guys think it was about? I mean, for me, it was the movies and the music that kind of drew me into the Disney culture. I mean, I was obsessed long before I ever set a toe in a park. I was the crazy Disney person, Disney everything. And so what is it for you that kind of drew you in? Because I didn't fall in love with some of the ideas and thoughts that Walt had until later on in life. I was kind of immersed into that that magic and escapism that was part of the film culture.
I think that was it for me. We didn't go to a lot of movies. We lived out in the country, and my parents weren't really that interested in movies. So we did, every now and then we would go see something. It was usually a Disney movie. And so I think I sort of became obsessed. And of course, it was before the days of VCRs and all of that. So to see a movie, you had to go to the movie theater. Even if it had been out for 40 years, it would come out in theaters again.
That's how I saw Sound of the South.
Yeah, exactly. I saw that. I saw 101 Dalmatians in Italian when I was in Italy. And that was the first time I'd ever seen it. I still remember, oh, famo, I'm hungry. So I learned some Italian from that as well, I guess. Yeah, I think, and I watched the TV show, the TV shows a lot, like The Wonderful World of Disney and all that. They were, they were obviously in reruns in 1971, and later, but they still were showing them all the time. And I think Walt Disney's charisma really came across on the screen, and not knowing anything about him, I think that, about any of his life, just seeing him on television, he was very intriguing. Yeah. It's like, here's this dream I have. Yeah. And by the time I was seeing it, it was built. So he would they would show him talking about this dream that he had, but it was actually a reality. So I really saw a man make his dreams come true without any of the work involved.
How did this guy make all these fantastic things? Yeah. I think it really, did. I think that show, The Wonderful World of Disney, kind of really just reached, because it reached into our homes, and it was such a highlight for me. I mean, we didn't have cable. That was, obviously we didn't have any paid for TV. So to be, it was the highlight of the week, was to be able to watch that. And
Sunday night tradition.
Yeah, Sunday night tradition. And boy, was it sad if you couldn't be home in time, or if you had something else going on, because there was no VCR or DVR to kind of help you move along. But there are so many things that, I'm going through, getting ready for this podcast, and I was going through, I didn't realize how many books I have about Walt. I think I have 8 that are sitting here right now with me, 8 different books about this person who dreamt this dream and turned it into reality, and kind of touched all of us with it. And I didn't realize how many of the things. And yeah, part of it is because if you spend too much time in the parks, you're inevitably going to walk by 5,000 walls for construction that are going to have quotes from Walt Disney. Right. And you're going to pick up a few things here and there. But
one of the best things I think you can do if you're in Walt Disney World and you're in Hollywood Studios is visit One Man's Dream.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Really, like, put some things into perspective, like the things that he created that just started animation as we know it, like that multi-plane camera that made it easy to like zoom in on a cartoon before you had to draw all those cells. And, just the little films, not always playing now. Sometimes they show clips about films that are coming out, but if you can see the film about his life and you realize that he failed, there were things he tried that did not work out and before he did this, and he kept getting up and trying again. You don't really think of somebody that successful as having failed before. Mm-hmm. And I think that's such an important lesson and an important thing for people to know about.
Well, my first introduction to Disney, now we're going to see who's the oldest person on the is that my grandparents, both of my grandparents were in New York City. My paternal grandmother had it must have been like a finished attic. And up there she had a film projector, because she would like go to Hawaii and stuff like that and take, take film. And one of the films she had up there was Steamboat Willie.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh.
And she taught me how to use the film projector. In fact, I have it. I still have the film projector.
Do you still have Steamboat Willie?
My sister has all that stuff because it's going to go
right now.
But I learned how to thread the machine and run the machine and watch it. And she had done like movies of us when we were little. So, that's fascinating as a child to kind of watch yourself. But that was my first, exposure to Walt Disney at all. That film. And my dad had apparently watched it. So, he knew a lot more about it than we did. So,
Well, you know, that was a short. So that was part of the thing about Disney too, is they said, I'm going to make a full length movie. And the world laughed at him. He was like, you can't make a full length movie with animation. You can't hand draw hundreds of thousands of cells. And he was like, oh yeah. And then Snow White comes to be. And you know, Snow White is a movie we still, you know, it has its weaknesses, but we still watch that movie today. Like, my kids saw that movie.
There are rides built around that movie.
Yeah, it is a true accomplishment in modern film and really in modern life. I mean, now we have computer programs that can generate animation like 8 million times faster. And that value of that hand-drawn animation is just, I just can't even, I mean, how did you pay people to create something like that? Like, right. It's so expensive. Well,
and if you listen to the stories of how he got that film made, I mean, that was pure work on him and his brother, Roy Disney's part of getting the financing for that, because like you said, nobody wanted to finance mm-hmm. that. And he had to act it out with all the voices and everything mm-hmm. in front of the, you know, them to get them to buy into it.
To get them to buy it. So one of the things that's really cool about his process to me is that he had the foresight in a time when cartoons were being made for kids to not make this wasn't just for children, this was for everyone. And he knew early enough on that by making it for a broader audience, it was going to have a farther reach and it was going to have greater success. And he was able to see, like a lot of great great people are, he was able to see something where no one else did and at the time, and I think that kind of set his work apart.
We went to Disney World as my sister was sick. There was something, I have two younger sisters. Renee is 18 months younger than me, and I want to tell you, maybe it was my youngest sister, I can't remember, one of them was sick. I think it's my youngest sister, and she has asthmatic bronchitis. She was born in 1968, so that would have been around. And my mom said, if you get better, when you get better, we're going to go to Disney World. I'm not sure I knew what that was, but I knew she was bribing my sister to get better. and my memory, or my really my memory of that trip is how much my dad liked it. He mm-hmm. He loved the Country Bear Jamboree. Loved, loved, loved. And we were, my sister's 18 months younger than I were small, you know, were young enough that everything was very real. I remember driving Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, and it was mm-hmm. real.
Yes.
That stuff was real. And then I came back and I wrote some essay, must have been like the third grade, about how I was in a submarine. You know, I was way down in the ocean, and my teacher, who was, you know, like a realist, kept telling me, no, there was this hanging these, I'm not sure why she was a teacher, because she just liked to, I said, no, they were not, those were real. We went way down in a submarine, you know.
I saw bubbles and everything.
I remember going back to Disney World probably 4 or 5 or 6 years later and getting in that Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, and I was like, they changed it. This is not the same.
No, you changed. You got
older. I had the same experience, because I remember that I was scared to death when I was 5, and I didn't go back to Disney World until I had graduated from college. And that was one of the first things I wanted to do, was ride Mr. Toad's Wild Ride again to see what scared me so much. And I remembered it pretty vividly. I remember going through the fireplace. And I mean, my memories of it were accurate, but just much, much bigger. And I'm so glad I did ride it again, because before it went away, because I mean, I know it's still at Disneyland, but I got to ride the exact same ride and see it from, and honestly, that's one of those moments where you're like, wow, the mind of a child versus the mind of an adult is so vastly different. And that line that we draw between reality and fantasy, kids do not, they don't even know where the line is.
There's no line for them.
Scary adventures. Of standing in line for that when we would go in college and seeing like young kids just bawling mm-hmm. when they come out
of what?
They were just crying.
Snow White. Yes,
the Snow White ride. More about the witch than mm-hmm. Snow White. And It really scared kids.
And that was just misunderstood. You were supposed to be Snow White running through the forest and experiencing what she experienced. And
which that is scary. It was pretty scary, Lizzie.
They had to add Snow White in. And
I need to remind you that Snow White ended up in a glass box. I mean, I think it's scary.
You cover all the eyeballs of everything staring at us.
So, my dad laughs so loud. Fairy
tales, he'll never sleep again. What you're talking about, that idea of the fantasy being real, reminds me of one of the quotes I read in that he said was that fantasy, if it's really convincing, can't become dated, for the simple reason that it represents a flight into a dimension that lies beyond the reach of time. And that's so true in all that we see inside Disney. I mean, look, today, if you go to Disney World, if you go to Magic Kingdom, there's a line at least 50 minutes long right now for Peter Pan.
Nobody wants to grow up.
Yeah.
I want to bring George in because he hasn't said a single word since we started. And I know Disney is important to you, George.
It is.
So tell us your story.
So my first trip was about the same time of yours, as in 1980. And at the time, it was still tickets, so A through E. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a one admission, get in and get on every ride. There was only Magic Kingdom. There was nothing else. I don't remember where. I remember that when we planned vacation, we were planning to stay in the Treehouse Villas. And then for some reason, something happened and we didn't. And I actually don't remember where we stayed, but it was off property. But it was just, that was the same as first trip I ever flew on a plane. Everywhere else, we had always driven for vacations everywhere. So that was pretty neat and cool when you're trying to think. I was probably 14 around then. So getting to fly in a plane and going to Florida and seeing Disney. And we grew up with the World of Disney on Sunday nights right after Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. And
And the Muppet Show!
Yep. But I'm going to tell you, Disney fans, if you have not done the Adventures by Disney Backstage Magic, you really need to.
Yeah. I will say I was very fortunate to be able to go to the studios, not with Adventures by Disney, but a friend of mine works for Disney and was able to give me basically the quote D23 overview of the studios, actual studio tour walk around. And it's such... It's kind of a church, if the world will forgive me for saying that. I mean, it's sort of a little bit frozen in time. And then, of course, there's all the Michael Graves stuff from the Eisner era as well. So it's got sort of the old Disney and the new Disney. And, you know, they've put up signposts to look like the old studios, even though it's not technically. Some of the buildings with the shuttered slats where Mary Poppins music was written, all of that stuff is still there. And it's amazing to walk through there. And even, I think, when you did Adventures by Disney, did they include the Walk and Waltz footsteps tour, or did they do, that wasn't part of it, right?
No. Nope, there was no separate tour. It was their own thing.
So George, I challenge you to do the Walk and Waltz Footsteps Tour. Am I right, Lindsay?
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, and then I will do the Adventures by Disney. Lindsay and I will do the Adventures.
We'll do that together this year.
You haven't done either one, so your challenge is to do both.
So yeah, I've done Marceline to the Magic Kingdom and Keys of the Kingdom already.
And then Keys to the Kingdom too. The Steam Train Tour is really, really good.
Yeah, that was the one thing we really wanted to do, was to go to Walt's Barn and being able to ride the miniature train. But yeah, it's only open one Sunday a month and you have to hit it just right to get there.
Yeah. So obviously the travel piece is part of it, but I think the whole magic piece, I think there's the very first biography I read, I had to do a book report in eighth grade and it had to be a biography. And I went to the biography section in the library and I just started going through, and fortunately D isn't too far into the alphabet. And I was like, no. Oh, Disney, Walt Disney. I'm going to read that. And that was my first exposure to the whole story, like the whole like failures, and grew up in Chicago and his dad wasn't very nice, and paper routes and like all of that, like really backstory stuff. Even Oswald was in that book too, although I think at the time I didn't quite understand what that really meant. And of course, knowing when you're reading a book about someone like Walt Disney and you know what he became, you read about the failures and you're like, oh, it couldn't have been that bad. But now as an adult, you read about those failures. He was completely bankrupt, you know, that like really, really big setbacks that as a kid, because that line
was not just one. It's not like he had just one failure. Yeah. He had multiple failures. And that was one of the things too, is that he said that, I can't remember exactly and I can't find where the quote is, but he said something about how it's important when you're young to have those big failures because it reminds you that you can fail and then you're more careful.
Yep.
It helps you. And of course, I'm going to paraphrase that. And that's probably going to be our first listener comment.
Well, actually, Lindsay, what he said was.
But I think, too, the fact that they had those failures and he kept, like, then taking on impossible projects. It's like, okay, I had this failure and now I'm going to make Snow White. You know, it's like none of his failures made him say, oh, I really can't do this. He's still like every failure made him dream even bigger, which is not something we as humans are just naturally wired to do.
Yeah, no. And he had like another quote I read that he said something about how his curiosity drove his inspiration and his imagination. And then once he completed something, he'd set it down. And that was, you know, like he's on to the next, he was always constantly moving toward the next idea. And he was never motivated by money, which is, you know, looking through the lens of today, it's very hard to
especially the Disney lens of today.
Especially when you're talking about Disney. Let's just get the big elephant in the room address. But yeah, for him, he wasn't. And he said something about money, which kind of like I'm also a little bit bad with money here too. But that's a whole nother podcast. but he said something about the concept of money has always been very vague to him. He only really needs it to get to his next project. So it was only ever really important to him when it was going to help build his next dream or his next goal. And I think that's really something that's unique and that you can kind of look to in, you know, even your own life, when you're setting those goals for yourself to have that pinpoint focus on, just certain things. Cause I think sometimes today people are kind of lost in the going for the cash.
Well, and I think, I mean, when you really look at the world in general and what thrives is you have idea people, Walt Disney, and then they surround themselves with people who can get things done. Walt Disney's brother. Right. So Disney didn't have to worry about the money because he had somebody else worrying about it. And he probably made his brother crazy. In fact, I think probably is really not even fair because we all know he pretty much did. I mean, his brother would say things like, I don't even know what he's thinking right now. But he would support him. Yeah, he would support him. And that sort of, behind every successful person, you get that sort of, the other personalities, you know, you need the creative and the logical together. And most people don't have both sides of the brain that work together. And you look at anybody successful like that.
You have to have the chaotic and the organized.
They have ideas and they have good senses of what people want, but they don't necessarily know how to make it happen. Or they're just generally, you know, like in the case of Steve Jobs, they're just so generally unpleasant that people have to go behind him and clean up and still make the things happen. So, you know, you when you have dreamers like that, you have to have those other people. And I think that's a valuable lesson that I learned too, was you can't do it all yourself. You know, Walt Disney's name is on the company and that's, you know, but if you know anything about the history of the Disney company, you know.
He couldn't have done it.
And he couldn't have done it without the Ink and Paint girls and like all of the people who worked for him, his animators who, you know, have sort of almost disappeared into history. Those core animators from back in the day.
Did you ever see the movie? There was a documentary about the animators from that first set of movies from like the Snow White, Cinderella, all those.
Nine Old Men.
But yeah, the Nine Old Men.
Is that what it was called? That was a really good movie.
It was one of the things, like the secret of juggling many responsibilities as an organization. Key men are responsible to me and constantly in touch with me to see that I'm there at the right time. These administrators keep things running. Mm-hmm. He really did. He kind of leaned on those people and delegated appropriately. I mean, he had the foresight to know that, you know, where he was in life. He was the dreamer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He was out of control creative, and that's not a bad thing. That, I mean, it sounds a little bit negative when I say it that way, but he's just wild creative. And so, yeah, you have to have somebody otherwise all he's doing is thinking all the time, like all these things. So yeah, he has to sort of have the right people to, yeah. And honestly, you look at a place like Walt Disney World and you think, how did this even happen?
Yeah.
Like, it is such an immense project.
Well, and I think it draws people who are like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have to be like, the people who have come after him, like the animators that worked on like Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and that whole set of animation that kind of rejuvenated the whole animation movie thing. I mean, there's so much brilliance. John Lasseter, who mm-hmm. is kind of out of the picture now, but I mean, there's just like those kind of people just work. I think they're drawn to that name, that Walt Disney legacy, and so that's what keeps it going. Mm-hmm. You know? Because there's so many good Imagineers who just have like more vision, and it's always changing. The parks are always going to change, and they're always going to be pushing the limits. And yeah,
well, and a lot. I mean, Disney, Walt had a lot of Walt. I'm going to call him Walt because we're super close.
We're so close.
But we know him. But he had very solid rules. And like, I remember hearing, and I don't have any proof of this, so internet, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I clearly remember what a big deal it was in Aladdin when Robin Williams brought in like Sebastian the crab, because Disney would never refer to another project. And it makes sense because his parks were built in the same, with the same idea too. Like, you can't see one part of the park from another except for the castle.
Right.
You can see that from most places, but which is the draw to the center to get you reoriented, the wiener, as he called it. Like, yes, because you would hold up. Yeah, his analogy, do you guys not know this? His analogy was you tie a hot dog to a stick and hold down
the dog. Elizabeth is a family
show. It is a family show. It is a Midwestern term. So there were lots of rules, and after he was gone, suddenly like people were still living by these rules. And then during the Eisner era, when the Swan and Dolphin were built, mm-hmm. and everybody was like, "Oh my God, you'll be able to see them from Epcot," and Eisner was like, "Yeah."
Well,
so they finally started breaking those rules.
He also came into Epcot and was like, "Where's Mickey?
Yeah.
Why are we not selling Mickey Mouse in an Epcot outfit?"
Yeah.
One of the other things that, you know, I mean, and I guess it's not really kind of an inspiration, more of a, oh, it's okay to be a little bit crazy and different, was that when I read, he said somewhere, and I can't find it again, but something about he functions better when things are going badly than when they're going as smooth as whipped cream, which is something that I can identify with, and I'm pretty sure that everyone else here can too as well.
You're productive when you got that time limit.
You got the deadline, and how, you know, that was another quote too. I vaguely remember like something about how we need those deadlines. Creative people need those deadlines. Otherwise you can become stagnant. I think he loved those analogies. Like, he used an analogy about beavers. And he's like, even a beaver in the summer can lollygag around all summer long and not get anything done without a deadline.
Well, I think that's why he was drawn to those stories too. I think too, part of the appeal to Disney was he took timeless stories and just made them continually timeless. Mm-hmm. Like, he changed these fairy tales, and we know he made them happy when they weren't. You know, we don't see Cinderella's feet getting all carved, or Cinderella's stepsister's feet getting all carved up to fit in the shoes. But if you know anything about the actual fairy tale, that's exactly what happened. And so he did. He cleaned them up and made them much more, you know, smiley. And that is yeah, for a long, long time, that is what the world needed at that time. And now we see Disney, you know, moving a little bit darker in some of their movies, and it's okay to, you know, bring up those themes that he never would have.
I'm going to put my folklore and fairy tale geek hat on, let my little freak flag fly here. I'm completely obsessed with the origin stories of folklore and fairy tales. I have about, I don't know, 100 books on written by Marina Warner and all the great professors who have studied the fairy tales and the origins. And what he did, I know he took a lot of flack for kind of the cleaning up of the fairy tales. But what he did was in keeping in line with the culture, because those are stories that were traditionally told as warnings to children to reflect the outside world that they lived in and prepare them for the life that they were living. And in an essence, in the same way, that's kind of what Disney did in, you know, for the modern age, which is kind of not the popular when it comes to fairy tales, Disney, but it's true. If you're looking at the origin stories and how those stories came about, why they were important to our culture and why these stories right now are important to our culture. So Laura, what are some lessons that Disney's taught you?
You know, I was just thinking, I was listening to you talk about kind of Disney's vision and stuff. And, you know, my dad was a pretty smart fella, really kind of geeky smart fella. And for him to like love the, like to get Disney's humor, to get the childness, I think there's some correlation between kind of visionaries, you know, like he was, that there is this child, there is this place that they don't lose in them, you know? And I think I started to tell you before that my dad laughed so hard and so loud every time Big Al would talk or sing at the Country Bear Jamboree that everywhere we went in the park, and, you know, obviously it wasn't the park of today, people were like pointing at him, like that's the guy who was laughing so loud, you know, at, you know, and the toucan room. Yeah, that, I mean, he kind of got all the, both in the films and in the park, he got all the funny stuff, you know, the child like stuff. He used to go around the house, you're talking about Snow White going, you know, when the dwarves are washing their face, you know, that was so funny to him, you know, and just out of nowhere, he'd just turn to you and go, you know, so I think my lesson lies kind of there, you know, that that the dreamers are revealed, you know, they're often complicated, as you've talked about, and that it teaches us that lesson, that, you know, that underneath what may seem like someone who's a step to the left or a step to the right that we don't quite get, there are the dreamers, there are the visionaries. And you know, when I was married, my husband, his favorite place in the world was Disney. Favorite place in the world. And he was a pretty quiet, introverted kind of fella. And we would walk into Main Street, get through the gates, walk into Main Street, and he would breathe really deep and say, "Doesn't it feel good to be home?" You know. So I mean, it's those lessons for me. It's those lessons of a place where people can feel home, where the world makes sense, where there's joy, you know, unexpected joy. And that's the thing I love most about Disney. I'm not one of these people who has to schedule my days out, but I love when a child sits and watch. I love watching other people fall in love with joy, you know? So, one of my favorite things is the topiaries. I love the topiaries. Themselves are magical, you know, out of this bush. There's so many little things at Disney World that you miss if you're racing through it.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the magic of Walt. It is the, how in Cinderella, you know, with Gus's top comes up and needs to be pulled down and comes up, and, you know, he's so into the details, so that people kind of would giggle in the midst of things, you know, they didn't miss the little things. And that's I'm not a big souvenir buyer, but I probably got 50 pressed pennies or whatever they were called. That was my big souvenir when we would go to Disney, and I would take pennies and quarters, and because it made the ordinary extraordinary. I think that was my, you know, it's like you took something very simple and made it whimsical. It took a bush and made it into Donald Duck, you know? So that's my Disney. Those are my Disney, you know, takeaways.
I think to,
to distill some of that, if I may, that I think one of the things that I've always loved about, especially Walt Disney World, but Disney in general, was, you know, we have a saying nowadays about adulting. Oh, I have to adult now. It's time to adult. Mm-hmm. And it's really just a way of saying, Disney gives us the chance to let our inner child run the place, and it's okay. It's like, yeah, you know, I don't have to squash my inner child when I'm here.
I can wear these ears.
Yeah, I can wear these ears. I can be totally goofy, yeah, if I may coin a phrase. I can scream my head off on a roller coaster. I can get scared at Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. I can do anything here. You know, I can fly in a pirate ship, and it's okay. And everybody here is in the same, you don't have to feel self-conscious about it or anything. You can literally let that inner child just run the place. Eat cotton candy, followed by a caramel apple, followed by popcorn. Good luck to you. It's okay.
Yeah, on your way out.
Yeah. And then there'll be a parade coming by again. You know, it's just a constant barrage of all the things that make us happy, and it's guilt free. You're allowed to do it. Yeah. Whereas in your regular life, you'd be like, and you know, as somebody who, I don't watch television anymore, and a lot of it is not because I don't like television. Television's fine, but I always feel like it's a waste of time. I feel like I'm not allowed to do that. You know, anytime I indulge in a movie or a TV show, I'm taking away from being an adult. And so I think that's, Disney World allows you, and Disney in general, a Disney movie, you know, going to see Toy Story, going to see The Lion King, all that are out right now, it allows you to escape and just accept and giggle and allow the magic to happen.
Well, it's also like a touch point for people now as they've grown up. You know, mm-hmm, it's that, you know, the friend of ours who we all have in this profession who loves Small World, you know, mm-hmm, and it brings back something. It's like walking in your grandmother's house and smelling the apple pie cookie. It brings back. And then every time you smell cinnamon, you're taken back to that apple pie. You know, it's like, mm-hmm, I think going on those kind of old familiars, you want to go on it every time because it washes over you. That childhood joy washes over you. So
my mother loved Small World, loved it to a point of obsession. And part of it was because she experienced it at the World's Fair, where, you know, mm-hmm, and so it brought back for her memories that had nothing to do with Disney. They had to do with being a kid at the World's Fair. And so it wasn't about Disney for her. It was about that experience. And then, you know, ironically, one of my father's very favorite Disney movies was The Lion King, and it came out not long before he passed away, and ironically with a story about a father passing away. And so every time I see The Lion King, I think of my dad, and it's not just because it's about a dad, it's because it's about my dad. Like, that was something that he really related to even before he passed away. So those, we all went, I was an adult, and we all as a family went to go see The Little Mermaid together, which is ridiculous, right? I mean, I am over 20 years old, and we're all like, we have to go see The Little Mermaid together as a family in the theater. And for my family that was not a movie family, we just really didn't go, that was monumental to go see that. And my parents loved it, and, you know, just could not get over how great it was to see the Disney revitalization, you know, because they grew up with the original movies. And that was, it was super important to them. So yeah, I think that those touch points, you're absolutely right. And now I see my kids developing their own touch points with those movies. And my son could go on, my youngest son could go on for hours about the merits of the live action Beauty and the Beast versus the original one, you know. And of course he wasn't alive when the original came out. So, but he cares about it a lot.
That's why I take my kids so much, because mm-hmm, I just want them to have that. Well, and I've definitely instilled the love with my daughter. I mean, my sons like it, but, you know, they are okay. At this point in their lives, they'd rather hang out with friends. If they can't bring their friends, then they don't really care. But my daughter would go anytime I asked her. You know, I could say, you want to go tomorrow? And she'd be like, yeah.
Yeah. Fashion back.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I predict into your future, Sandy, mm-hmm, all of your kids will be taking their kids to Disney when they're young.
Oh,
and they'll be telling them when my mom took me here.
Yeah.
Be like, you know, they may be not in that space now, but that memory is rooted, you know, deep in them. So,
yeah.
Yeah. When people ask me, like, what's the perfect age? I'm like, you're kind of asking the wrong person, because I took my kids at every age. And You know, I understand wanting to wait till your kids are older so that they remember and they don't need naps and all of those things. But to me, you know, I have a picture of Ellie dancing in Epcot with her little diaper butt sticking out and her binky in her mouth, you know, and Fox with Jasmine before they changed her outfit, you know, like all those things.
I picture my husband with Jasmine before they changed her outfit.
Yeah.
It's like, Elizabeth, get this.
Yeah. seriously. And my husband does not like the theme parks. It's not his thing, which is totally respectable. But he does enjoy going to Disney with our kids because he enjoys their experience at Disney. But that's actually a running joke in the house because I can assure you that my husband would never stand in line for a character. And we were there in the summer. It was 101 degrees outside. And he's like, Jasmine's going to be back in 45 minutes. Jasmine, I'm like, Finley doesn't need to see Jasmine, and he stood in line for 45 minutes.
I really love that. I mean, at the risk of sounding like that creepy lady who doesn't have kids, but one of my favorite things is standing on the edge of Main Street in front of the castle facing down toward the train station and seeing the looks on the kids' faces when they see Cinderella's castle for the first time. And I always said, when I retire and become independently wealthy, I'm going to move to Disney and sell balloons at the end of Main Street so that I can see that every single day, because that's one of the best
parts of the half marathon and marathon too. When you come around the corner and you see the castle and you're running down Main Street, that's amazing.
Yeah, and well, that early morning too, if you can get there in the early morning and have it all to yourself, it's really special.
Yeah.
And that's our show for the week. Thanks for hanging out with us. We'd love for you to share your life-changing travel moments with us on our Facebook page. You can find us on Facebook as Fly Away or from the podcast page on OutlanderTravel.com. Please be sure to subscribe to us and leave a review wherever you get your podcast. We'd love to hear from you. On behalf of Sandy, Laura, Lindsay, Elizabeth, and myself, George, thanks for joining us this week. Gotta fly.